What I'm going to cover today, we'll cover five main topics. Hopefully there'll be something of interest to everyone in these different topics, because I'm going to try and cover quite a lot of ground, starting with an overview of human tissues in the drug discovery process and why there is a need for these types of tests, and then provide some examples at different stages and case studies of how pharma and biotech companies have used them in their drug discovery programs. Look at that also in the context of the regulatory environment, what developments there have been there, the relevance of these models to safety pharmacology and some of the regulations, and also the evidence for species differences or similarities between humans and animals, and just finishing off with a point or two about where this field might go next, which is perhaps one of the most interesting areas for the Q&A. So starting off with the overview of the drug discovery process and the what we're talking about here in terms of human tissues. For about the past 10, 11 years, there's been a real increased focus, but as Yuri mentioned, we started a company called Biopta in 2002, about 7 years before this Time article came out, which named human tissue research biobanks as one of the 10 most important ideas in the world. So it's been about 10 years since that, that article. And one of the key elements identified was how this focus on human tissues and frozen fixed tissues, but also fresh tissues, could help to de-risk the whole process of drug discovery. And that's because at that time, and still today, there is a major problem in the translation of preclinical drug candidates into successful clinical trials and through to marketed drugs. So here's a review from 2019, which paints an improving picture. And we don't have the data, but hopefully increased focus in human models has maybe contributed to a slight increase in success. These data show the relative probability of success going from phase one through to launch. And you can see that starts off really with very low probability, going all the way through from a start of a clinical trial to launch. But as we get through the phases, of course, some compounds drop out and the probability does rise, but of course the costs of failure also rise through those phases. So there's still round about a 1 in 10 chance of getting through to the clinic from that late stage preclinical, start of clinical trials. And the causes of failure really mainly are efficacy or safety issues. There are other causes, there are commercial causes, there are issues with manufacturing and so on. I'm going to focus today on the issues around efficacy and safety toxicology. Another feature, of course, is that once drugs are actually through that process, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to be effective for every patient. So precision medicine is a big focus now for most drug companies. Numerous articles, including this article from Nature, showing that many patients receive partial or sometimes no benefit from the top selling drugs. So there's a drive towards better understanding of human biology at an early stage. So 90% of drugs fail. What can we do about that? Well, one area is to try and have better preclinical testing. So reduce clinical failures by improving what goes on at the stages before the clinical trials, so that you're only taking candidates through to the clinic that have a greatest likelihood of success. And to do that, of course, you need better predictive models. And that can come from many sources, stem cells, three-dimensional models, bioengineered models, and areas like bioprinting are very exciting areas of development. But also what I'm going to talk about today is using human tissue directly obtained from the patient population that you want to treat with the medicine. And that's where we're looking at the possibility of addressing efficacy, safety, even pharmacokinetics and bioavailability challenges using fresh tissue. So it's increasingly in demand, and I should have perhaps put a disclaimer at the start of this, of the, some gruesome images are essential in this talk, because I need to get across what we are talking about here in terms of the tissue models and their relevance to the test systems that I'll describe and the data generated. We're talking here about fresh, functional tissues and organs, and that's being increasingly used to gain confidence about the likely clinical efficacy, to understand the likely patient variation as part of precision medicine or stratified medicine approaches, and also to identify and understand potential safety concerns at an earlier stage. So they could be any number of different tissues or organs that are used. And I'm going to talk about examples of those, but also the challenges, because it's not easy. It's not a simple area. If it was, this would be the number one dominant approach to all of testing. But as we know, most testing is still done in cell lines, in animal models, and there are a number of reasons for that. However, there are drivers towards increased use of human fresh tissues. Some of the key drivers are shown here. Regulators are seeking to increase the use and encourage the use of human tissue testing. It may not be mandatory, but it is accepted and encouraged. And there are, as I'll show later on, regulations which encourage the use of human tissue models in the generation of human data. The nature of this type of work is that it's often outsourced to specialists, because it's, as we'll discuss, it's quite challenging to put everything in place around the logistics and the handling of human tissues. Then often it's a specialist lab that's focused on this, that pharma outsources to. There's a demand for ethical alternatives for non-animal models, and also this driver towards precision medicine, personalized medicine, where really we need human data, we need human tissue models to identify that patient variation. This was summarized by one of the founders of the biotech industry, William Hazeltine, who said this, around about the time we created Biopta, that it's really important to use as close to a total physiological system as you can. Otherwise, you're likely to run into trouble further down the road. So it's been recognized. The question is, how do you actually do that? Because there are many challenges in accessing human tissue. It's not always readily available. It's delicate. It can be difficult to handle and keep in good condition, keep it stable, or prevent it from deteriorating when it's been removed from the body. It has to be kept in good condition to remain relevant. There's, of course, lots of infrastructure and ethical considerations around the access and use of tissue, including for non-commercial or commercial research. And also the variability itself can be a challenge. There is no getting away from the fact that human tissue data is more variable than, say, an inbred or outbred animal model or a cell line. It's like a small clinical trial. And in the clinical trials, we see significant variation between donors. And that same thing is seen when you use a fresh tissue. So how do you handle that variability but still generate useful data? And one of the things we've seen is a real change over the past 20 years, from an avoidance of using human tissue models because of the variation, towards embracing that variation and trying to see that as a strength, to understand variation, in particular for precision medicine, at an early stage, so you can design better clinical studies, because you can look at different patient subpopulations and so on. And then acceptability, what are the requirements for regulatory bodies? How do we validate models? So there are a number of challenges. It's not, you know, there are strengths and weaknesses to these approaches. One of the key things is to develop a strong tissue network, because without that, you don't really have any way to do any of this research. And that takes considerable time, investment. It's collaborative. It involves building trust, building commercial relationships, but also research relationships with, you know, it's not something you can do just locally. It's something that has to be done typically with numbers of partners in order to get different types of tissues to work with different centres of excellence for all different areas of research. So it can be biorepositories, biobanks, maybe relationships with clinical colleagues, transplant networks, other commercial partners who are working in these fields to collaborate together, and also having the right ethical approval in place. As you and I mentioned, we set up our Biopta UK in Glasgow 2002. In 2011, we set up a subsidiary in the US, mainly because of our lab operations and our need to get closer to our tissue network in the US. So, you know, most UK companies will set up in the US for commercial or sales reasons. We really set up for operational reasons to be closer to the tissue networks. So those sorts of logistics are something that are really challenging and have to be thought through to get suitable access to, first of all, surgical residual tissue, which is one of the main sources. These tissues that are obtained from surgery and not used for diagnosis or are excess from diagnostic procedures may be donated by the patient with appropriate consent for research. And then they have to be shipped very rapidly to the laboratory. So again, there's challenges. Different tissue types will survive for different lengths of time and have different uses once they arrive in the lab. But as we'll show, you have to also be available in the lab 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to use these tissues. Another source is the transplant networks, which really is much more organized towards research in the US than it is in the UK, where organ procurement organizations, which work locally, also coordinate access for research, not just for organ donation, which of course is more important and comes first. The organ donor process, you know, takes prominence, that is the most important thing. However, if the donor or donor's family has consented to a secondary use for medical research, including, again, being very clear about commercial research, then that is something that may be done through companies, through academic labs, where they are able to accept these whole organs. And again, a very wide range of tissues, and we'll show some examples of those through the presentation, can be accessed and have to be transported rapidly 24/7. So this means having things like a phone line, a mobile line that's operated 24 hours a day, so that someone can be responsive to take offers or suitable tissues, and to be able to think on their feet at 3 a.m. against the crib sheet of what donor criteria are important for particular studies. So a lot of challenges, but if you can put that network in place and get appropriate quality tissue, these are the types of translational experiments that you can do. So residual tissue that goes rapidly to the lab typically will be dissected in some way. So you prepare the tissue, and you know that could be a primary cell-based assay, but today I'm going to focus on an intact tissue model. So keeping the tissue fresh, but intact as a tissue, such as a blood vessel, a section of mucosa, an airway, some intact three-dimensional structure where you're retaining that integrity and complexity of all of the cell types within that tissue. Again, of course, there are limitations. It's not an in vivo model. It is an in vitro, ex vivo perhaps model. So you don't have circulation. You don't have those other factors that would be present in a whole animal model, for example. But you can recapitulate many of the responses that you would see at tissue or organ level. For example, here we're showing some images of a small artery that's being constricted and then dilated in response to two different drugs. And that can be used as a proxy for potential effects on blood pressure. And by looking at really small resistance arteries, which are very important to control organ specific blood flow. So it's not high throughput, it's low throughput, but high relevance. And you're really looking for some clinically relevant endpoint or biomarker or something that will translate and offer that bridge between the preclinical and the clinical. So an example of that would be a heart tissue. Hopefully you can see that okay. Keeping heart tissue fresh, alive is very challenging. But if you can do that, you have enormously valuable data for effectiveness of heart failure drugs or safety screening of other drugs. So you can see that there are ways to tackle those human tissue challenges that we mentioned about access, about the quality of the tissue, all of the validation that's required. But really that has to all be put in place in advance, characterizing and training each site's abilities and the logistics. So in many ways, what we do and we have done is really sort out logistics. So I'm going to give some examples of that now at various stages of drug discovery. And really where human tissue is applied now goes all the way from early stage of target identification, mainly using fixed or frozen biospecimens from banks, very often non-commercial biorepositories. UK is excellent resources in that regard and very joined up networks of biorepositories. There's also some commercial biorepositories which have extensive networks. And you can look at the disease tissue to look at expression of the drug target. I'm going to focus on the fresh tissue models. So starting with functional target validation, which is not always done, but as a way to interrogate the behavior of a target and try and understand would engaging the target with a control compound, modifying the behavior of the tissue, would that be potentially of benefit? And would it help validate the hypothesis that the particular pathway is important in the disease? So what's important here is to be able to get both the healthy and the diseased tissue. Because without that, you're not really sure that you're able to treat the actual condition. And you might start off looking at a mechanism in healthy tissue, but really to go to the actual relevant disease, look at that pathway, see if there are differences. And sometimes, it may be that the pathway is upregulated or downregulated in the disease tissue, and you can see the response, and you can also relate that to the pathology, the clinical history of the donor. So here, for example, looking at some human lung tissue for treatments for COPD, measuring bronchoconstriction or dilation to different drugs, and also looking at the variation between different tissues by repeating responses. What's shown here is control responses to acetylcholine. But this does help to functionally validate a target. Look at the different number of patients, see if you have that variation. If so, try and understand anything in the clinical history or even genetic background of the patient that might help explain. moving on a stage to the test compounds and the potential drugs themselves. If you have a candidate that looks promising, the target's been validated, then we're looking at low throughput methods to functionally validate lead candidates. So here, for example, looking at a mucosa of human intestine to measure changes in the flux of ions across the mucosa as a way to measure fluid secretion. And that could be a treatment for constipation or diarrhea, for example. So you can do that analysis again in healthy or diseased tissue and give some comparative indication of lead compounds so that you can rank different lead compounds. And also importantly, compare them to marketed compounds or other standard of care compounds that are used for that particular disease. And then moving on to optimizing the qualities and the different parameters around that lead candidate, which include not only the efficacy, but perhaps also the bioavailability of the compound. And you'll see a lot more compounds now that are poorly soluble. So it can be quite a challenge to predict, especially for orally absorbed drugs, are they going to reach the target? There's also concerns around active efflux by transporters that would limit the absorption through the GI tract. So you can use that fresh intestinal tissue to model the permeability in vitro. And that translates very well. We'll come back to this. It translates very well in human tissue models to the actual fraction absorbed clinically. And then as we showed with the video of the heart, the beating heart tissue earlier, we can look at potential risks by, in particular, if there are known effects of a class of compounds, or if the regulators perhaps have flagged up an issue. Or quite often what happens is some signal in an animal model. Then you can check that using both the animal and human tissue in some cases. So you might take the same tissue from an animal model, compare that to the same tissue in human, and see is that signal still present? And if so, try and understand the mechanism or look at mitigation strategies to try and limit those adverse effects. So the human tissues can be used along the whole traditional drug discovery process, but also now there are increasingly examples in the literature of pharma and biotech companies using it in quite innovative and different ways to demonstrate efficacy, safety, or to validate targets. I'll just show some examples of that here. Firstly, a company called Proteon Therapeutics, who were developing treatments of atherosclerotic vessels and also fistulas for kidney dialysis. And they wanted to show the patency of arteries, compare the effect of their compound in rabbit models and other animal models, and also the translation of that to humans, and do some preliminary dose finding experiments that could be used to inform the clinical studies. So they were able to source atherosclerotic arteries, look at the degradation of elastin as a way to permanently dilate the arteries, and do that across quite a wide range of concentrations in vitro. It would be very expensive and difficult in vivo, or in certainly in humans, impossible to do that range of tests, and then use that to inform clinical studies, but also provide a proof of concept, which is valuable to the company, but also helps demonstrate to partners that, you know, there is early evidence here of efficacy. And so there's numerous reports, numerous publications from all different tissue types, different therapeutic areas, from skin to gastrointestinal, genitourinary. I'll not spend long on this, but it is there as a reference point. Most of these are freely available. But to give a few other examples, going through these different stages of drug discovery, Muraxon were a company with a quite unique challenge in that they were they discovered quite early on that the animal models they were using did not translate to the human condition, and were really looking for some model that could inform them of the potential inhibition of endothelial nitric oxide synthase when they were looking at other inhibitors of either inducible nitric oxide synthase or neuronal. And so they wanted to separate these out by using different models of human tissue and try and assess, could they modify the chemistry, test a small number of the compounds. And again, we're talking about somewhere in the region of 5 to 100 typically compounds. It's not high throughput because it's these models are quite labor intensive, but they are very late stage preclinical, and use the data to submit to regulators, which we'll come back to. And in a similar vein, Merck, one of the publications that's freely available, using human tissues to look at marketed compounds and trying to explain some of the known side effects that have been, clinicians have been aware of for years. Could you use human tissue to try and explain what might be underlying those potential adverse effects? So they looked at antiarrhythmics to understand the potential effects on cardiac contractility and also vascular relaxations, and were able to find potential explanations for flecainide around cardiac contractility, which related to the observed clinical side effects. So again, a number of publications that I won't labour the point, but you can feel free to look these up. And also there are review articles in this area. They've just covered a snapshot of some approaches. Robert Coleman, who established a company called Pharmagene, he has pulled together a review of the area, human-based systems for translational research, which may be of interest as a summary of human tissue research and drug discovery. So the other couple of areas that I'd like to focus on in the rest of the time before the Q&A are around the regulatory environment and then species differences. The regulatory environment's a really fascinating topic because there's been quite a bit of work done in the UK led by NC3Rs and MHRA. There's a publication in Nature Reviews Drug Discovery of some of the work done by a working party that was established by NC3Rs and MHRA a few years ago, which involved pharma, CROs, and others in academia working in this field. And it was really to try and understand what are the barriers. Many of the things that we talked about at the start of the presentation around using human tissue in terms of its access and also the challenges around validation and so on. And what they did was conduct a survey of industry where Big Pharma got all of its key scientists together to do one return. So each Big Pharma company gave one survey answers, and they collated them into this publication. Again, it's free to download. I'm going to summarize a couple of the key points because it relates to how human tissues are being used. One of the things that we were very interested in is whether people were actually doing this type of work, and if they weren't, did they intend to do so in future? So around about 50% currently used these types of approaches, and they were also evaluating them. The vast majority were considering or evaluating them. So there was a trend towards increased, certainly considering increased use. And the main reasons for that are shown here. They were human tissue models are more relevant, so unsurprising. But also a legislative requirement or a company aspiration to move from in vivo to in vitro models. The poor predictivity of animal models or lack of suitable models. Cost was a factor, but not seen as one of the main ones. Really more about this human relevance. And coming back to the start of the presentation about these challenges around finding useful preclinical models that are going to give the best prediction of clinical success. That was really the main theme in the responses. And the way that the different groups were tackling these problems varied from tissue slices or ex vivo tissue preps to different more complex engineered tissues, 2D or 3D cell cultures. So a range of approaches. Again, every year we're seeing, you know, increased number of these models from organ in a chip through to the bioprinting. And really, we also have the other end of the spectrum that we talked about today of the human tissue model that's come direct from a patient. And I think these, at some point, will converge as the 3D models become more relevant. The human tissue models are going to help validate some of those, but we are still a long way from having the variation in patient response, diverse genetic, environmental, medical histories that you get from fresh tissue. So really, these two areas are going to continue to develop in parallel for the foreseeable future. And in terms of those guidelines, I thought it might be useful. It's a bit of a dry slide, but just to summarise some of the actual sections of the regulations that, in particular for safety pharmacology, where human tissues are relevant or are even specifically mentioned with regard to endpoints. So you'll see these are things such as respiratory system, cardiovascular system, gastrointestinal effects. There are other, of course, other areas where it's much more difficult to have a human tissue predict an effect, such as central nervous system responses. Nonetheless, there are these few areas where they are directly used, and that's often the case that we will see requests for particular studies from the regulators or from pharma against these guidelines. And I'm going to just show one example of that today in the respiratory system, because I think it's quite a nice example that relates to the next section on human and animal species differences, and also some of the challenges of relying only on the regulations. So I'll show how the regulations are structured and what types of endpoints are considered important, but also looking at some of the actual causes of clinical failure because of safety issues, and how human tissues can also help mitigate these risks. Starting with, of course, the tissue access, you know, everything comes back to being able to get access to these tissues. So where can you get lung from? Either surgery or lung cancer and other, you know, conditions, or whole lung from transplant network. And again, could be healthy lung from the transplant network that's otherwise not able to be transplanted for various reasons, or healthy margin from a surgical resection, or it could be diseased tissue that we're looking at. And safety pharmacologists are typically interested in lung tissue studies because of similar reasons to other therapeutic areas or other types of compounds, because there's some unexpected observation during a clinical trial. So maybe the drug has gone all the way through and is in the clinic and there are unexpected adverse effects. And then there's a step back taken to try and understand whether there is any explanation by using human tissue. We can try and understand why. It could be observations from in vivo animal models. It could be known species differences that are, you know, have to be understood by using human tissue. It could be requests from regulators. But it could be because of a desire to go further than just the regulations. So to use human tissue to help characterize the known risks from the regs, or also other issues that may be important in terms of known drug failures that are even beyond what is requested by the regulators. So to broadly summarize what respiratory safety endpoints are typically considered, and I'm talking here about safety pharmacology, so acute effects rather than any tox effect. That's looking at the ventilatory apparatus, so the respiratory muscles, the control of breathing volume, tidal volume, respiratory rate, and so on. Or looking at the effects of the drug in the gas exchange unit, so down in the airways, the alveoli, the vasculature. So these have different, slightly different risk profiles and effects, of course, on the individual. Ventilatory apparatus is the main focus of the regulations. So in terms of what has to be done to meet the regulatory assessments, that's really what's looked at. And in vivo animal models are the main way to do that. So you can measure tidal volume, respiratory rate, and so on from an animal. However, pharma also needs this information about the gas exchange units. So how do you do that and why? Why do they need that information? Well, if we actually look at those areas, the ventilatory apparatus and the gas exchange unit, and we see from this, this is analysis by Dennis Murphy at GSK on the causes of problems in the clinic due to respiratory safety issues, then you can see that around 60% of the problems are actually due to the gas exchange unit, not ventilation. So if we just go by the regulations, then we're missing around 60% of the problems that then cause failure or issues in the clinic. So how do we measure those issues? Well, if it's airway obstruction issue, we could measure airway resistance. If it's a lower respiratory tract abnormality, we could look at things like lung compliance. So why not simply go from, you know, the in vivo animal model will tell us about ventilation. Could we just use an in vitro animal model to look at the gas exchange unit? Well, you look at the data from the in vitro animal models, we'll see why that's not satisfactory. So for example, in rats, trachea, bronchi, you see these sorts of responses to acetylcholine, serotonin. Humans, there's no response at all. And in fact, if we plot the potency of the some typical controls that we would look at, spasmogens from the airways, then we see the bronchial reactivity in different species. We can see that only human tissue would accurately reflect the human responses to these bronchoconstrictors. So very difficult to find an animal model that would actually predict the changes in the gas exchange unit based on what we know about the species differences. So this section on regulatory testing explains one reason why the regulators are encouraging greater use. It's not mandatory, but they are doing it on a case-by-case basis, and they're encouraging companies to look more at human data. So for example, to take human airways and do those same experiments as a measure of airway resistance or compliance. So that brings me on to the last section, because we've started to talk about species differences between humans and animals. And certainly what, you know, is not the case is to say human tissue is always the way to go and that animal models are no use. It's far from the case. I mean, you know, we very much have depended on animal models, as I'm sure you're all aware, to develop compounds. There are many good predictive models. It really is a case-by-case basis and careful consideration of where human or animal models most appropriate and effective for the particular program. So I'm going to highlight some examples of differences in the potential risk, but by no means are, you know, saying that that means that the animal models are not predictive in many cases. Purely to highlight that there are probably more examples of differences than we realize. And that's partly because there's so much more data in animal tissues than there is in human. And for all the reasons that we explained earlier, trying to get access and the logistical challenges, there's just far more publications in animal models. And so sometimes we see quite stark differences, such as here in some small resistance arteries looking at responses to 5-HT, where we have very small responses in dog, but really pronounced responses in humans. And that, you know, has led to some false confidence in predicting a drug being safe in a dog telemetry model, for example. And then that goes on to the clinic and we see adverse effects in humans. So it's really a case-by-case basis and giving very careful consideration to the particular class of compound, the literature, and also the particular risks around what the drug's target is. Here's another example we did in collaboration with J&J, looking at, again, differences between dog and human, where the risk profile presents, you know, it's higher risk if you're using a dog model here because it's less sensitive, the tissue, than the human model. So if it was the other way around, for a safety assay, you might have some false positive signals for safety, but here we're getting some false negatives by using the dog models. And then this final section in species differences, looking at bioavailability. So safety is one of the key areas for species differences, but another important and very well characterized area in the literature is around bioavailability. So here we found no one species that really reflects all of the characteristics of the human GI tract. So for passive oral absorption of compounds, rats are actually pretty good. But in terms of metabolic enzyme activity, they're very different. And actually, this is quite controversial graph. There's a lot of debate about whether this is a fair reflection of the landscape or not. But you know, it's intended to show the lack of translation between human and animal. And it may be not quite as complex as shown here, but nonetheless, there are there are significant differences. For example, with dogs, we see almost the opposite situation from the rats, that the passive oral absorption is not well predicted. But actually, in other respects, the dog's pretty good model. Whereas in non-human primates, we've got similar passive absorption, but again, like the rat, differences in metabolic enzyme activity. So it can be the case that you're looking at a particular compound, what's already known about it, what is the suitable model? Is it Caco2 cell line? Is it some animal model? Or is it even a human fresh tissue model? And a group at AstraZeneca in Sweden really led the way by collating about 17 years worth of experiments that they did in human tissues using a technique called an Ussing chamber. And then comparing the in vitro permeability values to the human fraction absorbed values for those same compounds. And they found very good correlation. And we've repeated some of that work and so have other labs to show really good correlation if you use that intact intestine and it's fresh enough and you've qualified the quality of that tissue. And really another key point about the species differences, just to finish off in the last few minutes here, is that the advent of precision medicine means that it's only really human tissues that will tell you about the variation in drug response between individuals. Because we know that we can look at species differences, but we also have to look at differences in susceptibility to safety or other adverse effects between different donors based on their clinical background and genetic background. And that brings us round to really a final point about a key driver for human tissue is precision medicine and trying to understand that variation in response. And where do we go next? Well, one thing that's a big focus in Scotland is trying to bring together the health system with academia, with clinicians, with many of the initiatives that are out there across the UK, across Scotland. There's, you know, some excellent biorepositories. There's obviously the gene sequencing projects. There's expertise in genomics and artificial intelligence. And what we've been doing recently as a, you know, what comes next, just to finish off, is to try and harness the power of AI and machine learning to better understand these relationships between pharmacology, the fresh tissue response that we see, and also the clinical histories in the donors and the genetic or transcriptomic background of the patients. So to summarize, the human tissues are being used to sometimes to add commercial value, to reduce risk, to look at species differences, to troubleshoot clinical problems, compare directly animal-human test systems or cell-based systems with human, and there's increasingly an openness from regulators to the use of human tissue. So thanks very much, very happy to take questions, and also my email address is there if anybody wants to follow up with any discussion after the webinar. Thanks very much.